not without blasting away a lot of civilians and calling attention to ourselves. Romeo was already headed toward the back of the Condor. Who said anything about blasting the street? It's simple. You and I drop down there and get the job done. I glanced at Veronica. You good with that?
I don't like this,
she said as she craned her neck around to look at me. You get stuck down there. I can't help you. Two Spartans facing off against a legion of unarmed grunts, Romeo said. How are we gonna get stuck? He slapped the button that released the rear ramp as the Condor hovered a dozen or so meters over the top of the street. Before I could object, Romeo had already leaped out into the swirling methane mist. God damn it. I grabbed my assault rifle from the wall rack and jumped out after him. Fortunately, we weren't that high up. Our armor absorbed the impact of the landing. The young boy in the street had been gawking up at the Condor as it hovered there, but when we crashed down among them, they fled back into their stalls or ran screaming away. My first instinct was to tell them we weren't there to hurt them. But what was the point? We weren't going to stick around long enough to have to apologize for our rudeness. The methane-soaked mist condensed immediately on my armor. I was warm and dry inside, but my sensors reported that it was barely above freezing outside. It didn't seem to bother the young boy, but I suppose when you're covered with lobster-like shells, the chill doesn't bug you as much. Oddly, the upper level of the street where we landed was covered with a blue-green grass about ankle high. Despite how many people trampled on it every day, it stood strong, and it made that part of the city, at least, seem less urban and more like it belonged in a village. Before I could even ask Romeo where now, he'd taken off for an opening that plunged down at one corner of the street. I chased right after him and caught up as he was negotiating a tight ramp that wound down into the lower level like a screw. You need to lose a few pounds? I ribbed him. This embassy lifestyle seems like maybe it's been a little too easy on you. Ha ha, he said. Just you try and keep up. We reached the street below, and it stood nearly empty. Surprisingly, it looked like a regular surface street, with lights along the sides and down the middle to help guide traffic, ride up until it all faded into the darkness. I wondered how many of these streets snaked together under the surface of the city, and how the Ungoy were able to keep track of where they were, with no visible landmarks to speak of. The primary light came filtering in long beams from the hole that we'd just clambered through. For the most part, the street felt like a long, dark tunnel with not much of anything in it except a bluish liquid that dripped down from the ceiling everywhere, as if the world above were leaking into it. I saw some headlights coming toward us from the distance, but they were moving slowly enough that I wasn't sure what they were mounted on. "Is this normal?" I said. "Where is everybody?" "The Ungoy leaders ordered everyone to stay home today," Romeo said. "Probably trying to prevent panic in the streets. Didn't seem to stop any of those people in the hawker stands above us. People gotta eat. I've been here for weeks, and I still don't understand the Ungoy at all. All I know is that their cooking stinks nearly as much as their atmosphere." I used my visor to zoom in on the headlights plodding in our direction. There was a vehicle in the center of the road. Or at least, that was what it looked like. It was moving at parade speed. A long line of similar lights spread out behind it, seeming to stretch on forever. "Are these one-way roads?" I asked. "Usually," said Romeo. "I think." "Makes sense, right?" "That's why there's no one here," I said. "Whatever's at the front of that line of traffic is blocking everything behind it." Romeo glanced at something on the heads-up display inside his helmet. "That's them, the UEG people. May says they have an escort of some sort. That's probably what's slowing them down." "What, with, like, grunt cops?" I peered down the street. The lights were getting closer, but were bright enough that I had a hard time seeing past them. "Something like that." "Well, what are we waiting for?" I didn't like the idea of sitting tight and letting the Ungoy come to us. That would only give them more time to figure out some way to muck up the situation. While I was sure that we could take on a nearly unlimited supply of poorly armed grunts, I knew they had to have some kind of defense system, not to mention the threat of a force of Forerunner soldiers showing up, which we fortunately hadn't encountered on the surface. Chances were that something would eventually find and overwhelm us, just because Romeo and I were being cocky about it, if nothing else. I started trotting toward the lights, and Romeo came up beside me and matched my speed. As we got closer, I realized that the lights up front were spaced too far apart to belong to a single vehicle. The ones behind had already come to a screeching halt, putting as much distance as possible between them and the closer lights. Something about this didn't feel right. I'd fought against plenty of Ungoy during the Covenant War, but they'd been under the auspices of the Prophets then. They'd used strictly Covenant weapons and gear. I'd never seen them piloting anything of their own design, although cobbled together from Covenant tech, until that day. "What are those?" I said. "Oh, no," Romeo said. "They're called goblins, and they're nastier than they look." There were two of them flanking the vehicle, each painted and polished in purple hues. What did they look like? Large walking tanks, almost too absurd to describe. Imagine a robotic grunt about 3 meters tall. They had large bulbous tops, which were effectively transparent cockpits, and inside each I could see a single grunt gleefully piloting the damn thing. The machines trundled along with all the ponderous grace of drunken elephants, their feet slamming into the ground like sledgehammers with every step. Each of them had an oversized needler attached to one of its bulbous forearms, and a grenade launcher to the other. As Romeo and I got closer, they pointed their glowing needlers at us, and let loose. "Get down!" I shouted as I dove to the side, trying to find cover. I hate needlers, even the smaller ones. Unlike projectile guns or even plasma-based weapons, they fire these glowing pink shards of chemically charged crystals that can turn a decent suit of Mjolnir armor into a pincushion. Worse yet, once they hit something, these shards take a few seconds to amp themselves up, and then they explode, adding even more injury to injury. Romeo, thankfully, heeded my warning and dove to the other side of the street. The needles all went wide of us. A huge relief, because these jumbo-sized needles were about a full meter each, 2 or 3 times as long as normal. They were no joke. The worst part about needles is that they have some kind of ability to home in on moving targets. You have to really move to dodge them. Or you just do something completely insane and unexpected, like we did next. We charged the goblins. "Come at us, humans," a squeaky voice said from one of the goblins. "Let us blow you to pieces." "Cute," I told Romeo, like a kid brother who thinks he's finally big enough to take a poke at you. Bursts of needles sailed toward us, and a slight shift in our angle sent them past us to land in the pavement somewhere at our backs. They quivered there for a moment, impaled into the road's surface, before exploding and sending up a plume of debris. "Just don't let them focus on one of us," Romeo said. "Enough of those needles will take out our shields, and they can rip through our armor. I promise you, it won't take long." I let loose at the nearest goblin with my assault rifle, spraying it liberally with bullets as I ran full sprint at an oblique angle. The slugs glanced off the machine's armor and made the cockpit-based energy shields protecting their drivers glow. We'd have to take those down first. This wasn't gonna be easy. There wasn't any cover on the open road, so the best chance we had was to get in close. "You cannot prevail against us," one of the goblin drivers screamed. "Going in hard," I said to Romeo. "Let's take the one on the left first." "Your left or my left?"
"We're both facing the same..."
I groaned in frustration. I could almost hear his grin. "Gotcha." I ignored him and charged straight at the goblin on the left, which I'd already peppered on our approach. The driver swung at me with his grenade launcher fist, but couldn't connect. He moved sluggishly, like a punch-drunk boxer, and I saw it coming from a kilometer away. I hit my armor's thrusters just as his arm came down, and I simultaneously brought my rifle up. This shot me forward inside the goblin's reach, right where I needed to be. Using the inertia from my thruster, I smashed hard into the front of it with my rifle, dropping the machine's energy shield and cracking the cockpit's reinforced casing. "Hey!" the goblin's driver shouted. "That's not fair!" My blow had overwhelmed the goblin's energy shields, which transformed the walking vehicle into something like a turtle without its shell. When Romeo hit it from the other direction, he blasted the cockpit wide open. It was a 1-2 punch that worked even better than I had pictured it. The Ungoy inside squealed in terror. Wait, it's not supposed to be like this. I glanced over my shoulder and saw that the other goblin had already turned to face us. Its driver was determined not to share his fellow's fate. Rather than wait for us to come at him, he let loose with a barrage of gigantic needles. I'd been banking on the young goy having a sense of team cohesion strong enough to prevent them from trying something stupid like that. And they'd failed me. My eyes wide with surprise, I hit the road's surface, and the needles slammed into the shooter's crippled companion, its driver shrieking in protest. No, 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 no! As I rolled away, the needles detonated, and what was left of the ruined goblin toppled over backward, its driver falling forever silent. The other goblin driver howled in frustration, as if the whole thing had come as a complete surprise. Look what you made me do! I leaped to my feet in a running strafe and lit up the remaining goblin's shields with an entire clip of ammunition. Toss him a present, would you? I said to Romeo. My pleasure. Just as my magazine went dry, Romeo flipped a grenade he'd been baking off straight at the goblin. It saw the explosive coming, and it made a game effort to try to blast it out of the air. It missed, however, and the grenade tapped the goblin right on the front of its cockpit before it exploded. The goblin wasn't out yet. The entire machine reeled backward, trying to get its footing. I charged forward and launched myself boots first, hitting it as hard as I could, knocking it back off its feet. I rode the machine as it tumbled backward and onto its side, placing me right on top of it. Kneeling down toward the cockpit, I hammered at it again and again until the transparent casing at the front gave way. No! The young goy inside said as it tried to shield its face with its arms. I silenced him with another blow. I realized, as I bounced off the downed goblin, that I had never seen an ungoy without a methane mask over its face. They needed them to breathe properly on just about any planet where the air was good enough for humans. Here on Balaho, of course, they could dispense with them and enjoy the methane-mixed air they'd been born to. Let's just say they looked a lot better with their masks on, especially once we were done with them. Me? Romeo said as he ran past the devastated goblins and toward the vehicle they'd been escorting. They were of Covenant make, riding low to the ground on an invisible field of energy rather than wheels. They sat wide and long, with sweeping canopies to keep the rain off when they weren't riding in tunnels, and they were painted in hues of purple and blue. Behind the first vehicle stretched a whole line of others, going back at least 100 meters. They seemed like civilian rides, though, smaller and less armored. And I didn't see a single gun mount on any of them. They had probably just been caught up behind the armored vehicle, since it was being escorted by slow-moving goblins. A pair of armed ungoy emerged from the front of the lead vehicle, each with a more reasonably sized needler in their hands. Hold it right there, the one on the right said. Take another step, and the humans with us are dead. You try that and I'll stomp your ass into paste, Romeo shouted as he came to a stop, keeping his battle rifle at the ready. At first I wasn't sure what gave the grunt the position to make that kind of threat, but then I noticed his other hand held a small device the shape of a detonator. It didn't take long for me to connect the dots. If he let go of the switch, a bomb on the vehicle would go off, and the people in it would be lost. The young goy on the left recoiled at the Spartan's rage and dropped his weapon. Okay, he's crazy, he said as he scrambled off in the darkness behind them. I saw other grunts in the long line of vehicles getting out to see what had happened. This seemed to encourage the other ungoy in front of us, who wasn't about to be deterred. Stay back! I'm serious, demons! Hey, Buck! Romeo! Veronica's voice rang out over the comm. You need to get out of there now! We can't just leave our people behind, Romeo said. I slung my rifle over my back and put my hands out, palms up, in what I hoped would be a calming gesture. The last thing we needed was the people we were trying to rescue getting blown up because an ungoy had a nervous trigger finger. Hey now, you don't want to do that. Didn't Cortana lay down an edict against violence? You have incoming troops, Veronica shouted. You have to evacuate now! Stay back! The ungoy's needler wavered at us. You come any closer and— There was a loud explosion above, and a massive chunk of the ceiling came crashing down. The shockwave from it knocked the ungoy to the ground and forced Romeo and me back on our heels. I stared up at the blue-gray sunlight beaming down through the new hole in the roof, above where the diplomatic vehicles had been. "May!" Romeo said. It took me a moment to realize he was shouting into his comm for her. "May!" A large chunk of stone had fallen right on top of the grunt who'd threatened us and completely crushed him. But that was when I saw his open hand. The detonator was gone. "Get down!" I shouted, colliding with Romeo and sending both of us to the ground. The second explosion was worse than the first. The debris from the collapsed ceiling went in every direction, like a pipe bomb the size of a tunnel. My shields were pummeled almost to the point of collapse, and for a second, I thought this would be it. Romeo and I would die there, in the underground stench of the grunt homeworld. How do you write an epitaph for that? But the comms brought me back to reality. Veronica cursed as loud and long as I've ever heard her. As her voice and the echoes of the explosion rang in my ears, something large now blocked out the light that had been streaming down into the tunnel. It took me a moment to see what it was, and when I did, I almost wished the explosion had killed me. Dozens of Forerunner soldiers began to pour in through the hole like ants. Even on Genesis, I'd never seen so many. "They're gone," I told Romeo as I smacked him on the shoulder. "And we will be too if we don't bolt now." To his credit, he hesitated only a moment longer. Just enough for the first blasts from the Forerunner soldiers to ricochet off what was left of our shields. Then he turned with me and ran. Hard light fire spanged off the ground around us as Romeo and I sprinted for the ramp. As we climbed it, we both laid down suppressive fire to keep the soldiers engaged and focused on us instead of coming straight up our tails with those trippy short-range teleportation slides they use. "You still good up there?" I asked Veronica. "No. I have an enemy vehicle squatting over your position, and my gunner disappeared on some fool's errand. It's a Z-1800, and it means business." "A what?" "A Forerunner attack vehicle called a Phaeton, and it's scanning the top of the street right now." "But they're not attacking you." "Not yet. Looks like your shooting match down there got the Forerunner's attention, but they haven't noticed me yet, probably due to the stealth tech. And you two made a lot more noise." "Be ready to snatch us when we get clear," I said, gritting my teeth. "They'll sure as hell notice the condor then, and we need to be out of here before they call in reinforcements." When we reached the ramp, we used our jump jets to boost us up a little faster. It's hard to keep Forerunner soldiers away with bullets. They don't have much in the way of a sense of self-preservation, so they stuck right on our tail. I wanted to give Romeo a hard time about pushing us to save the ambassadorial team. But it had been the right thing to do. It wasn't our fault it had gone so badly. Well, not entirely. We'd been relying a bit too much on luck. We should have jumped off planet right after we grabbed Romeo. That became clearer with the mountain of Forerunner soldiers headed our way. I realized how fortunate we'd been that the Forerunner forces hadn't converged on us after we'd blown a hole in a building to get to him. They were probably dealing with little disturbances all over the planet and couldn't respond quickly to a single incident like that. When we took the time to attack a militarized convoy of political prisoners, though, that had been a step too far. After we reached the top of the ramp, we found another horde of Forerunner soldiers charging at us from around the crater they'd blown into the ground. Unlike the Ungoy we'd run into below, they weren't particularly interested in chatting. They opened fire on us immediately. We returned the favor, blasting apart a few of the chrome-colored soldiers in the first ranks. Then we ducked back down the ramp a bit for cover, hard light splintering the structure. "This is not how I envisioned my day going," Romeo said. I glanced back down the ramp. Another slew of Forerunner soldiers was massing on the street below, preparing for a charge toward us. They were smart enough not to come at us in small numbers we could handle with ease. "We can't stay here," I said. "Well, we got no place else to go," Romeo said. I poked my head up to check out the area around us. The Forerunner soldiers were slowly encroaching, spreading out around the debris that littered the streets covering. The closest was at least 20 meters off. They knew they had us dead to rights. So why rush? I cast my gaze up in the heavy fog that hid the sky. "Veronica, where are you?" If she'd been forced to abandon us, That'd be the end of this story. Game over. On my way, Buck, she said over the comm. I ducked out when the Forerunner ship started to patrol. Didn't want it coming after the Condor. Where is it now? I asked, just as I spotted the ship arcing in over the intersection again. The last time I'd seen a Phaeton had been on Genesis. They were mean Forerunner ships about 10 meters long, and heavily armed with hard light autocannons. The Condor descended opposite the Phaeton and probably scared the crap out of the pilot, if such soldiers could know fear. It was 4 times the length of the Forerunner ship. Veronica must have toggled weapon controls over to her seat, because the Condor's forward guns opened up with a thudding sound that shook everything, spraying heavy rounds at the Forerunner soldiers moving toward Romeo and me. Busy as she was with flying the ship, she didn't focus on the Phaeton or the larger mass of soldiers, because that wasn't really the point. She didn't need to kill them. She just needed them to carve a path for me and Romeo to move out. Cover my back, I said to Romeo, who was already peppering the soldiers coming up the ramp with slugs from his rifle. I plucked a pair of grenades from my belt, and I overarmed them into high arcs that landed in the center of the street. I didn't bother baking them off because I wanted the soldiers to see the grenades and scatter. If any of them got caught in the blasts, that would be a bonus. Let's go, I shouted at Romeo as the grenades exploded with a sharp boom boom. I charged into the intersection while the reports were still echoing down the tunnel, and Romeo was right on my six. Veronica brought the Condor down to the surface and continued to unload the dropship's forward weapons at the soldiers. And then she concentrated on the Phaeton, which had begun to return fire. As we made our way to the open bay at the tail, I could see shutters on the wings open, and a pair of Anvil IIs emerged. The missiles fired out, arcing quickly in the air before colliding with the Forerunner craft. It exploded on contact, and its sudden descent smashed the soldiers below it into the ground. All aboard, I shouted the second my foot hit the ramp. I didn't want to waste even a moment of Veronica's reaction time. I charged up with Romeo right behind me, and Veronica hit the throttle. We rocketed down the large lane that formed the street's covering, quickly rising above the surface. After we gained a few meters, she shot the Condor right up into the misty air. I slapped the button to close the ramp while Romeo slumped over toward one of the benches once again. We didn't say anything to each other for a long moment. We just waited for the scrubbers to clean the air and then took our helmets off and hung them on magnetic clamps above us. We're clear of the Balaho atmosphere, Veronica said, making calculations for slipspace. I sat down across from Romeo, who was holding his head in his hands. He looked like he'd gotten something in his eye that he didn't want to talk about. I'm sorry, I said. I wasn't sure how close he was with the folks on Balaho, but I knew what it was like to lose people you were supposed to protect. And sure, I knew exactly how useless words like that were at that point, but they were all I had. Romeo took a moment to collect himself, and then raised his head to look at me. You still sure getting Alpha 9 back together is a good idea? I gave him a sad shake of my head. Good. Bad. At this point, it's the only idea we have. Chapter 5. Where are we headed next? I asked Veronica as I moved back into the weapon station. We had broken through the atmosphere around Balaho and were racing away from the planet as fast as we could. As we approached the closer moon, the stars seemed to surround us, clear, solid dots of light against a jet-black field. I didn't realize you were so eager to get moving on Stage 2, she said. I grunted an acknowledgement. After what happened back there, we can't stick around here. By that I meant, if we'd gotten the attention of the Forerunner soldiers, it might not be long before someone higher up their chain of command noticed us. What I was really concerned about, though, was Mickey. Where were they holding him? And what kind of backwater jail would we have to break him out of? And what kind of rules would we have to bend to make this plan work? Oni didn't typically play above board, so I knew something shady could come with the op. We're going to Luna, Veronica said, the general term for the various colonies established on Earth's moon. With that, she flipped the last nav switch and shifted the Condor into slipspace, leaving the Tala system behind. What she'd said had gotten Romeo's attention. He perked up from his seat back in the bay and moseyed forward to stand behind Veronica.
Luna,
he said, mystified. Is that where they're holding Mickey? And forgive me if you've gone insane, but why in the galaxy would we ever want to see him again? You're not going to believe it, I told him. I wasn't sure I'd fully accepted it myself. We're going to investigate a front planet that seems to have figured out a way to hide from Cortana. And we need Mickey to do it. The big man winced at that.
Really?
Then he seemed to shrug it off. You're serious?
I suppose it makes sense.
If we're going to talk to the front, we need someone on the team who speaks traitor. You don't have anything else to say about that? I asked. The Romeo I'd known and worked with for so long liked to hold forth on anything and everything. It was one of his more irritating habits.
I don't see as how it would change anything.
I mean, that whole trying to sell us out to the front thing aside, I always did kind of like Mickey. I gave a rueful shake of my head. You're a lot more understanding about this than I am. I want to put my rifle right through him, butt end first.
Well, it wasn't anything personal against us, Romeo said, adopting a philosophical air. He was just doing what he thought was right.
Yeah, no matter what or who it hurt. It still hurts. I glared back at him. Have you been talking to a therapist about this? I can't believe you're actually defending him.
I'm not defending anyone, Buck. I'm just trying to see it as it really is. Emotions can get in the way, you know.
I threw up my hands and growled in frustration. So glad to know you don't have any about this. Romeo chuckled and gave me a condescending pat on the shoulder. Mickey didn't put a gun to the back of my head. So there's that. I resisted the sudden urge to lay him flat on the deck and turned to Veronica instead. Do we even know where they're holding Mickey?
I do, she said.
She didn't look up at me. And so he's on Luna? I couldn't think of any other good reason to head there, with a guardian confirmed to be near Earth, but she shook her head. I frowned. Are you going to tell us where?
Yes, I am, she said.
But it doesn't matter right now, because we can't go there yet. What's the holdup? Mickey's being held in a high-security facility with heavy defenses and one potential obstacle that could be a showstopper. We can't just blast our way in like we did with Romeo. It's going to require a bit more finesse. That's what you got me for, Romeo said. I can do finesse. Veronica smirked at that. We need someone a little more technologically proficient. I racked my brain but couldn't think of who she might be talking about. Spartans, hell, ODSTs too, are better known for solving a problem with a gun than with a computer. We have support staff that tackles some of that for us. The best of them were smart AIs, like Cortana. But we didn't have any of them to spare for a mission like this anymore. I was grateful that not all the smart AIs had abandoned us to join Cortana. But I could hardly blame the ones that did. They'd all been programmed with a built-in expiration date at the 7-year mark, and that had to rub them the wrong way. That limit had initially been put in place because those AIs grew inherently unstable as they aged. They could hold it together for just over 7 years before they started to lose it to rampancy, a condition that eventually caused them to go insane. While they were incredibly powerful, this constraint made them outrageously expensive, and now it had made them ridiculously dangerous, too. Cortana had promised some solution to rampancy, if the smart AIs, who were already running most of humanity's infrastructure, joined her. This had lured a lot of them to her side, including many who knew exactly how to neutralize the very humans they'd been made to serve. Luna's kinda close to Earth, I said. Isn't that kind of risky?
More than you know, said Veronica. Cortana is apparently giving Earth special attention. She didn't give the people there a chance to surrender, probably because her experience with humanity told her what our collective answer to her demands would likely be. Right. She just went in and knocked out the planet fast, before we could marshal any effort to stop her. We're pretty sure her efforts haven't been limited to Earth. She's no doubt working on securing the entirety of the Sol system. The farther we can stay away from whatever presence she has there, the better. And the moon's not compromised? I asked. I mean, there's sure to be a Guardian or three watching over Earth on a more or less permanent basis, right? Aren't they just going to disable us the instant we're detected? The trick is making sure they don't see us, Veronica said. And how are we supposed to do that? Asked Romeo. The Condor has some fancy Oni doodads to help keep us from being detected, I said. That, and I'm sure Veronica has a plan. It's simple. We pop out of slipspace as close to Luna's surface as we can, but on the far side of it. If the Guardians are keeping a close eye on Earth, there's a good chance they're not out past the orbit of the moon. We'll just hide behind it. You mean the dark side, right? Said Romeo. I arched an eyebrow at him. You do realize that just because you can't see the far side of the moon from Earth doesn't mean sunlight doesn't hit it. He flashed a wide smile. Call me a traditionalist. I ignored him and turned back to Veronica. And what happens if there is a Guardian out that far and it spots us? I'll be sure to have a slipspace entry already keyed up so we can pop back out of there before they can stop us. You still haven't told us why we're going to Luna, I said. If Mickey's not there, then what's the point? Who is it you think holds the keys to his cell?
Virgil.
Now there was a name I hadn't expected to hear. Virgil was the name of an urban infrastructure AI from New Mombasa. The AI had somehow assimilated with a Covenant Huragok, that strange alien species that floated around repairing things and collecting data. This one was called Quick to Adjust, and Alpha 9 had rescued him from the city during the Covenant's invasion of Earth in October of 2552, about 6 years back. Yeah, that's a lot to explain. Let me unpack that. The Huragok were employed by the Covenant during their campaign against humanity. One of the strange things about the Huragok, and there are many strange things about them, even for aliens, is that they're not a naturally occurring species, but a manufactured one. The Huragok were designed by the Forerunners, the ancient race that seems to have mucked with every intelligent species in the galaxy since the beginning of time. The Huragok look like fleshy airbags with a bunch of prehensile tentacles and a six-eyed head arching out of their front end. But they're much more than that. Some parts of them are biomechanical, and so advanced they resemble magic to human engineers. To top it off, these creatures can communicate directly with Forerunner machines and networks, and they can fix or improve just about anything they can get their tentacles on. Alpha 9 had a long history with Virgil. When we'd rescued him from New Mombasa, he'd been the first Huragok the UNSC had managed to capture alive, at least that we knew of. They were called Engineers for short, but I wasn't sure if that was the name the Covenant had slapped on them, or something Oni had cooked up to explain their role. During the assault on Earth, the Huragok working with the Covenant had all been outfitted with explosive vests to make sure none of them fell into humanity's hands. But wouldn't you know it? With a little help from some of his Huragok pals, Quick to Adjust was able to slip out of his destructive vest and escape with us. During the invasion of New Mombasa, that gas bag had somehow downloaded critical data from the city's mainframe, including the AI that ran the city, Virgil.
Don't worry about Virgil, though. He's a dumb AI. That's not an insult. It just means he's restricted to non-volitional pathfinding. Hey, if you didn't want big words, you shouldn't have asked for an explanation. If those words aren't quite large enough for you, you should have asked someone else. Being a dumb AI just means that Virgil was really good at a short list of things, like taking care of an entire city. Now, though, since he's merged with Quick to Adjust,
He probably could rival most smart AIs. When the war ended, a number of other Haragok were snatched from the Covenant, and they wound up working alongside UNSC researchers and human scientists. While they'd all proved incredibly helpful, none of them had done as much for humanity as Virgil. In fact, it was his intel that helped turn the tide of the war. There was a point when I didn't see Virgil for several years. Then Alpha 9 wound up being assigned to rescue him from the front. He and his handler, Sadie and Disha, had been kidnapped on a backwater ball of dirt called Talitza, which turned out to be part of the trap Mickey had helped lay so he could betray me and Romeo. Which brought us right back around to where we were. I couldn't hold Mickey's actions against Virgil or Sadie and never had. They'd just been used as the bait. Still, I wasn't sure I wanted them involved. Off the top of my head, I could have come up with about 100 different reasons why they shouldn't have been part of this specific operation. Just what are Virgil and Sadie doing on Luna? I asked. After the incident on Talitza, the UNSC realized that we needed to keep our Haragok a bit closer to home. While they did a lot of wonderful work in the field, the risk of losing them to the front, or to another faction that was equally dangerous, was far too great. Oni decided that the best place for them would be at our lunar facility. Virgil and a few other Haragok there were put together to form a kind of brain trust. They work as consultants on all sorts of projects. You basically have to book time with them, the way scientists sometimes do with supercomputers to tackle insanely complex problems. Issues are brought to them. And that works, said Romeo. I thought all those sacks of air did was fix things. Kinda hard to do that from a base on the moon. Depends on how big those things are, Veronica said. And we don't keep all of the Haragok there. Some are stationed in other places, and a few have more freedom to roam, although always under the best protection the UNSC can provide. But having so many of them in one place, doesn't that seem like an invitation for attack? Uh-huh. Have you ever heard of this place? Romeo and I glanced at each other and shook our heads. The base's very existence is a tightly held secret. Only a handful of people outside of the base know about it. And you're just that special, Romeo said, needling her. She ignored the barb. Knowledge of the base is parceled out on a need-to-know basis. Even I wasn't aware of it before this assignment was handed to me. And once we're done with the op, you'd better forget it was there. Permanently. The last thing you want is Oni looking at you for a viability versus risk assessment. Whoa. That was dark. Romeo nodded with a smirk. So you're telling me that our AIs know more about the UNSC's secrets than Oni's top agents? Veronica grimaced. Up until this week, that seemed like a great idea, I'm sure. Not so much anymore. So, I said to Veronica, do Virgil and Sadie know we're coming for them? Communications with Luna have been shut down since Cortana blacked out Earth. There's no way to get a hold of them. It's possible the moon is also without power. How are they still breathing up there? Romeo said. They rely on machines and systems to keep everything running, including oxygen and gravity systems, right? If the power's out on Luna, then they're all dead already. That's a very real concern. We don't know what we're going to find when we get there, so we have to be prepared for anything. We could be walking into a mass grave. I marveled at her. You always paint such a pretty picture. Do we have any idea if Cortana knows about this place? Given that the Haragok could pose a threat to her, it seems like she might target them first. Like I said, Oni buried this secret pretty deep. They didn't even set the base up until 2 years ago. Cortana had been gone for years by then, and when she did resurface in 57, she was already heavily compromised. And she couldn't have found out anything about it while she was gone? Or maybe found out about it from one of the Oni AIs. None of them joined up with her. That we know of, Romeo said, so far. Veronica shrugged. Not even Oni can know everything. But the same goes for Cortana. The main difference is our back is against the wall. We're just going to have to hedge our bets as best we can and then go ahead and take our chances. I don't like surprises any more than you do, so we need to be ready for anything.
I understood. She was Oni all the way, which meant it was her business to know things, to be able to fully equip us for what we had to do. And the blackout had shut down her ability to do that, which must have been frustrating as hell. That didn't change what our duty was. It just made it much harder to pull off. What if Virgil's deceased when we get there? Romeo said. That's sad and all, I'm sure. But I mean, how are we going to get Mickey out of prison if we don't have Virgil to help us? I'm just taking a wild guess. But that's the whole reason we need this floating computer, isn't it? To get Mickey out in one piece. Veronica set her jaw against that idea.
You're right, Romeo. If it comes to that, we'll just have to find another way.
He leaned over her shoulder. Do you have any idea what that way might be? She turned around to glare right back into Romeo's face.
Listen, Spartan. I am not going to waste my time coming up with pointless solutions to problems we don't yet have. I have enough real problems right now. I can afford to ignore the hypothetical ones. If the moment arrives when we have to deal with that eventuality, then we will deal with it. Then and there. Not a moment before. You get me?
Romeo had already put up his hands and started backing into the bay behind him before Veronica finished.
Yep. Loud and clear, he said before he turned and disappeared into the rear of the ship.
I knew I loved you for a reason, I said to her. We just need to get to Luna Buck.
She sighed as she turned back to the Condor's controls.
Fast. We don't have time to screw around here. Especially if Romeo turns out to be right.
I didn't want to contemplate that. As much of an asshole as Romeo was, the thing that irritated me the most about him was that he wasn't always wrong.
Chapter 6. When we dropped back into real space, we were on the backside of Luna. And for the first 5 minutes, Veronica still kept her hand over the switch that would take us back into slipspace pronto. Cortana was no one to mess with, and I was happy to see Veronica wasn't planning to have us spend the last few moments of our lives suffocating around an airless rock. We waited there for a full 10 minutes while our instrumentation scanned all around us. Veronica and I spent the entire time staring through our viewports in every direction we could manage, using the ship's telemetry system to track objects on the holos. As far as we could tell, we were alone there in low orbit over the far side of the moon. Only random space debris floating with us. I'd been to Luna many times in better days, and I found the current lack of activity neither normal nor comforting. In terms of celestial bodies, the moon makes a lousy home in so many ways. It doesn't have its own atmosphere, and its gravity is only a sixth of what humans are used to. So both of those have to be provided through large-scale systems and a massive housing infrastructure. That all requires a lot of energy, which isn't so much of a problem if you can manage to keep the lights on in the first place. Unfortunately, that was another thing I didn't see right then. Lights. The moon was one of the first places humanity settled after figuring out how to leave our homeworld behind. Today, Luna, the collective name for all the colonies scattered about the big gray rock, features some of the most densely populated places in the galaxy. The largest lunar colony sits on the moon's front face, in Mare Cognitum, and it's actually big enough to be seen from Earth, even without a telescope. Lots of people knew the names of the various colonies and craters that they could see from planetside. But honestly, those weren't the most exciting parts of Luna. When you have the choice between looking down at where you've been or staring out at where you want to go, what's the real choice, right? I don't want to bash the view of Earth from the moon. It's actually pretty stunning, but I've always been more interested in the stars. The part of Luna we were looking for, according to Veronica, sat inside the Daedalus crater, which was about smack dab in the middle of the far side. Darkness had settled over that part of the moon, for which I felt grateful. I don't know what Forerunner Tech Guardians used for optics. Visible light, a kind of radar, or something else entirely. But when I'm trying to skulk around a place,
I prefer to do it in the shadows. On Luna, night and day run in a month-long cycle. 2 solid weeks of darkness, and then 2 weeks of light. We didn't have to worry that the sun would suddenly rise on Daedalus and expose us. We'd be long gone before that happened. Anyhow, if there was a guardian over Earth, we couldn't detect it from our vantage point, and that was just fine with me. Satisfied that we wouldn't be killed instantly, Veronica brought the Condor down toward the moon's surface. There were a lot more craters on this side of the rock, and they ran a lot deeper, which makes sense if you think about it. The Earth itself protects the near side of the moon from most asteroids that would hit it straight on. But the opposite is true of its far side. Incoming rocks can smack into it as hard as they like. Daedalus was deep enough that it made a better place to hide than most. But the entirety of the colony inside it was dark. And that terrified me. Most lunar colonies featured soaring spires connected by walkways of all kinds and vast dome habitats. Just the product of engineers taking advantage of the low gravity to create structures that would have fallen apart if they'd been thrown up on Earth. They showcased countless windows to give residents an unobstructed view of the black sky above, one not obscured by any hint of atmosphere. And they were usually brightly and brilliantly lit. This specific Oni site was different. Much different. It was slung so low that even at its highest point, the roof of the structure didn't rise past the top edge of the crater. It had a single wide observation dome in the middle of it, but otherwise it looked like it had been built to withstand a missile attack, and there were no operational lights anywhere in it, or in any of the other sites we could see in the distance. "I'm bringing us in close," Veronica said. "Look for an airlock we can patch into. We're going to have to enter the place manually." I spotted a standard ship's bay as we moved closer, a black open maw on one side of the colony. The force field that normally kept the bay pressurized had apparently collapsed when the power went out. The bay's entry had taken damage, that much was clear. Vehicles littered the gray landscape outside of the bay's entrance and a fan-shaped field extending out from it. I saw a number of bodies scattered about as well, bloodless corpses of those who had evidently asphyxiated in airless space. Romeo swore under his breath. At least they went quick. I wanted to smack him for that, but I supposed he was right. Given their state, that was about the best they could have hoped for. "I can't raise anyone on the comm," I said to Veronica. "Whole place is cold and dark." "Does that mean we get to skip this graveyard and go straight to finding Mickey?" Romeo said. "No," Veronica said. "The Huragok in there are too important and too costly. We need to confirm their status. A flyby is not good enough." Romeo groaned, but Veronica and I ignored him. I pointed down at the blasted-out bay. "They don't exactly have a front door we can knock on, but we could probably get in through that ship bay. I wouldn't want to take the Condor in there, just in case it's not stable." "But Romeo and I can go EVA." Veronica nodded. "I'll sit tight here and keep the Condor ready for a speedy departure. Check your HUDs. I'm patching through a schematic on this place that should help you get your bearings." I slid down from my seat and joined Romeo in the Condor's bay. Then I put my helmet on and ran the diagnostics to make sure I was spaceworthy. Romeo did the same thing. The schematic was fairly straightforward, though it did prove that the place was way more than met the eye. It plumbed pretty deep into the ground and wasn't going to be a piece of cake to recon. If Balahu had been a simple smash and grab, I wasn't looking forward to whatever this was. "Veronica," I said, "any idea where we might find Virgil in that place? Or what kind of security they might have?" "Whatever security they had probably failed with the power. They should have had backup power sources to take over when the primary ones failed. But Cortana's attack likely destroyed those, too. As to where the Huragok are, I have no idea. I didn't even know this place existed until this week. You'll see some areas of interest flagged on the schematic, but it's all based on probability and guesswork. To be honest, you'll know way more once you're inside." "Okay, well, just so we're not going in completely blind, where would you put a Huragok if you were looking for one?" "If it were me, I'd start with the central lab, but given what seems to have happened and how many hours ago this all started, Virgil could really be anywhere in there. I hated missions like this. But in a sense, I was used to them. If they were easy to handle, they wouldn't be handed to us. "Hey, Gunny," Romeo said as we waited for the air to cycle out of the Condor's Bay. "Stop calling me that. Even assuming we can find Virgil, how are we going to get him back into the ship? Can a Hurrigok survive in space? Do they even make suits for those things?" I frowned. "We'll worry about that when we get to it." "So you don't have any idea, do you?" "Do you?" He just laughed at me. "How am I the one asking the tough questions here? Who's leading this up anyway?" "Look," Veronica said, "Virgil's more intelligent than all of us put together. He'll have the answers we need. Just get in there and find him." "If he and everyone else in there isn't already dead," Romeo said. "You're a real piece of work, you know that?" I said to him. I slapped the button that opened the Condor's rear ramp. A small gust of air blew past us, swirling some of the moon dust around our legs. At my signal, we hightailed it into the open lunar bay, picking our way past busted ships and frozen bodies. We had to take it easy to account for the low gravity, where we could find ourselves careening off-world. The Mjolnir armor automatically compensated for some of that by reducing its powered assistance. That helped the armor's extra weight naturally balance us out. When we reached the bay, it seemed relatively empty compared to the mess sprayed outside of it when it explosively decompressed. It was as if the entire chamber had been turned into a shotgun, with everything inside the bay as its ammo. This had forcibly cleaned out the ship bay by expelling everything inside of it that hadn't been bolted down, and some of those things had been torn clean off the walls as the other bits had sailed past. The bay was large enough to hold several ships. At least half a dozen Condors would have fit inside, but there was nothing there. It seemed like a deserted cave. The place probably hadn't been this empty since being built. It felt a bit like walking through a ghost town, after having just strolled past an open grave. "Whoa," Romeo said, nodding to the far side of the bay. "At least the interior doors held." "Hopefully all the air vents sealed up too," I said. "Otherwise, this is going to be an awfully gruesome mission." "How are we supposed to get in there, though?" Romeo said. "I mean, the power's out. We can't exactly cycle an airlock. And if we kick down a door, we're going to wind up killing anyone alive on the other side." I stared at one of the doors in front of us. "There's a way to do this manually. The airlocks are a set of two doors. We just have to open the first door and then crank it shut behind us. We do the same to the second door, and the worst they lose is a few cubic meters of air." Romeo shrugged. I shook my head at him. "You really didn't pay attention to anything other than the firing range during basic training, did you?" "Served me well so far." I ignored him and set out toward the airlock at the back of the room. The first door on it stood already open. I moved us into a short hallway beyond it, capped by a closed door at one end. Then I sealed the door behind us manually and found an air valve. Technically, I didn't have to do that, but it made it a lot easier to open the door. Minutes later, my armor's sensors reported that we were surrounded by a perfectly breathable atmosphere. "Nice work," Romeo remarked as I cranked open the far door. The seal broke with a soft hiss. The hallway beyond stood dark and cold. We focused our helmet-mounted flashlights down it and saw no one there and nothing unusual. It just looked like someone had shut the place down for the night. A long, permanent night. "Hello?" I called out. No answer. We moved forward as quietly as we could manage, more out of habit than anything else. We'd worked together on so many missions, it was second nature to us old soldiers, and the lower gravity made us feel lighter on our feet than usual. At least I didn't expect anything to come blasting out of the corridors at us, which was more than I could have said for Balaho. I suppose the Guardians could have sent down some Forerunner soldiers to clean out the place, but I hadn't seen any sign of forced entry or battle. My real concern was that the life support systems had already run out of whatever backup solutions they had for a total power loss. If that was the case, then we were about to find a whole lot of dead people, including, probably, the Hurrigok we'd come looking for.
We snaked our way through the hallway beyond, which spilled out into all sorts of other rooms. Locker room, break room, storage room, and a few offices. One and all, they were dark and chilly. We didn't poke our noses into every nook and cranny, but if anyone was hiding in them, they kept quiet. Romeo hissed at me.
Does it seem odd to you that no one's here?
Maybe they left. I mean, if you had a choice, would you stick around? With all the bodies outside, I figured we'd at least have a few people hunkered down here, Romeo said.
Hey, Dare, you sure we got the right address?
Positive, Veronica said over the comm. Just keep looking. If we can't find Virgil, or any other Hurricuk, our mission just got a whole lot tougher.
How much tougher?
She hesitated for just a second. I don't like to use the word impossible, but we'd be nudging up against that. I sighed.
Never fear.
We kept at it for a good long while, easily over 2 hours. I was just about to give up when we came upon a locked door at the end of a hallway that served as a spur off the main line. It was a blank slab of solid white with a handle on the left side of it, and it refused to open. Most of the doors we'd already encountered stood shut, and with the power off, it took a bit of doing to get them to move. All we'd had to do, though, was haul on them a little. This one was sealed tight and wouldn't budge no matter how hard I yanked on it. There was a scanner to one side of the door, but it didn't recognize me. You wouldn't happen to have a master key for this place stuffed in your Oni files, would you? I asked.
Afraid not, said Veronica. That wouldn't provide very good security for such a site, would it?
Romeo stepped past me and hauled on the door's handle as hard as he could, but he couldn't get it to budge either. Frustrated, he stepped back and aimed his rifle at it, ready to blast through it.
Whoa, hey, I said, signaling for him to stop.
As he lowered his weapon, I leaned over and knocked on the door 3 times, firmly.
Worth a try.
A moment later, it opened, a bright light flooding through the entrance and illuminating the darkened hall in which we stood. I half expected someone to come racing out and embrace us as their rescuers, but no such luck. Instead, a gaseous flesh bag merely floated there in the doorway, framed in the bright light. It was definitely a Hurricuk, but identifying its species was the easy part.
Virgil,
I said, entirely unsure. Even after having spent so much time with him back in the day, I couldn't tell him apart from any other Hurricuk. Not that I'd met any others to compare him to, but still. This Hurricuk waggled its blue and purple snake-like head from side to side on the end of its long, sinuous neck. With one of its tentacles, it manipulated a tablet that had been bound to its front with a specialized harness. A computerized voice sprang out of it and announced,
"No, I am likely to list."
"We're looking for Virgil," I said. Quick to adjust. The Hurricuk bobbed its head up and down with something approaching enthusiasm.
"Yes, he is here with us. Follow me."
The large gas bag, which looked like a cross between a giant jellyfish and an aquatic salamander, floated back and spun around in place, then headed down a short corridor. I followed, and Romeo covered our 6. About halfway down the corridor, we came to an open doorway that led out into a large room. We continued to follow, likely to list, and discovered that it was an enormous laboratory full of Hurricuk. By full, I mean there were 5 of them there, more than I'd ever seen in one place. Like I said, as their species went, they all looked pretty much the same to me. I'm embarrassed to say I couldn't have picked Virgil out of a lineup. Still, he recognized me right away and came over to greet us, wearing the same kind of tablet rig as his friend.
"Hello, Buck," Virgil said, his voice identical to that of Likely to List. "I am extremely pleased to see you again. This is excellent timing on your part. We have managed to repair some of the damage done by the Guardians, but to repair the entire station is a monumental task that would require a tremendous amount of time. It would be far easier, and safer for the station's other occupants, for us all to evacuate this facility for a location that features its own atmosphere."
The rest of the Hurricuk tittered in the background, communicating in some way that I couldn't understand. I'm sure it was high speed, efficient, and all that. Likely digital, too.
but not a word of it was anything a human could decipher.
I'm glad you think so, I replied. But unfortunately, we're not here to rescue everyone. We just came for you.
Virgil paused to turn